Welcome on to a Tuesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. Big news today, the Serge Ibaka trade. He is no longer a member of the Orlando Magic. He is on the Raptors now. Terrence Ross, a first round pick going back for Ibaka. And then also maybe even bigger news, Kevin Love out 4 to 6 weeks with surgery to clean up loose bodies in his knee. We're going to talk about that. We actually are recording this part of it earlier on. And then we did the rest of the 15 and 60 and some news yesterday. So maybe a little inconsistent with the 15 and 60 since we did the Cavs and talked about the Magic and ironically what we would accept and trade for Serge Ibaka and what he would get. So it'll be interesting to kind of think of what that looks like for a day old now, but I'll leave it in just because I think it's interesting to see how this ended up really compared to expectations. Our sponsors today, stamps.com, use the cap space code to get a month-long trial, and Betterment. Betterment.com/capspace is your way to get up to 6 months of no fees for lower-cost automated investing. So let's start with the Ibaka trade first, Danny. My first reaction was, seems about right.
Yeah, I mean, we spent a little portion of the trade deadline podcast figuring out a fair return for Serge Ibaka once it was pretty much determined, because Millsap got traded first, that he was going to go there. We ended up with a different package, but the overall price is right.
Yeah, I thought I did slightly better as the Magic GM to get Jakob Poeltl, Delon Wright, and Fred VanVleet along with Jared Sullinger for salary matching purposes. But here, the package, to reiterate again, Ibaka for the worst of Toronto's or the Clippers first round pick, and Terrence Ross, who's making about $11 million this year and next. And that's about right to me. For Ross is a little bit superfluous in Toronto. They have Norman Powell. The fact that they get off of Ross's salary for next year, I think, is important if they wanted to re-sign Ibaka. And of course, they have to re-sign Kyle Lowry as well. If they do re-sign Ibaka, we may see that Jonas Valanciunas is not long for the team, but that's after this season. I think that'll be an issue, and maybe Ibaka will not re-sign. So it does seem about right to me. If you compare it to some of these other trades that have been made, these were bad deals, but you know, the Jeff Green trade in 2015, the Aflalo trade in 2015, those were better picks actually that got traded for clearly worse players at this point. But then also you throw in the fact that Ross is a decent rotation guy and the Magic desperately needs shooting. And I think this was the best that Orlando could have hoped for. I'm not going to say that they sold low on it at this point. And I'm glad at least that they're able to admit defeat, admit the sunk cost of Ibaka, and move on from him.
One small correction, but it's important, is that Terrence Ross has two more seasons after this year, and they're both at $10.5 million. And
yeah,
the reason that
he
matters
signed an
is
extension.
That's a reasonable contract moving forward. You know, it's not perfect. It's not a rookie scale value or anything like that. They don't have restricted rights at the end of it, but they are getting a rotation caliber player, even if he's not a starter long term, for a rotation price. And he could get better. He's improved substantially this year from where he was last year when he was the most maddening player on the Raptors. He probably still is the most maddening player, but it was different. He was much better in terms of pull-up shooting, which is very interesting. I want to see if that continues. But what Orlando got in this deal was they got a late first round pick, which is fine, and they got a player who makes sense with their team moving forward, because while Ross is arguably their best shooting or the best small forward right now, even though he's a natural two, he can easily slide into the backup spot, you know, that kind of first swingman off the bench, and Orlando needs that guy, and I think that having him at $10 million is better than $10 million in cap space.
Yeah, I think that that's probably right for Orlando, and we'll get to the implications, of course, for Toronto's competitiveness in the East momentarily. But for Orlando, I felt that it helps in the sense that now they can move Aaron Gordon to the four, though Hennigan wouldn't commit to that. He said that's up to the coaches. Gordon is better at the four offensively, to be sure. He's just not a good enough shooter, despite some games where he's blown up. His jumpers looked a little bit better, but generally at the three, especially if he's playing alongside Elfrid Payton, just not a good enough shooter. So getting him in some pick and rolls, getting him moving to the basket, much better for them, I think. However, you can do more switching as well at the four. But defensively, now with Fournier and Ross, if those two guys are going to play together, which it would seem they would, they don't really have anyone who can guard anybody good who's a wing other than Gordon. And if you do that, you're now leaving Fournier or Ross guarding the other team's four. And that's probably untenable from a rebounding standpoint, you know, from a help defense standpoint as well, if you've got Aaron Gordon trying to smother the best perimeter player on the other team. So still in the long term, having Ross as more of a sixth man, I think works well. well. And then they still really need, ideally, another combo forward next to Gordon who can shoot the ball and also guard fours to really have this team come into place. Of course, now they still need someone who can actually do something off the dribble and create it. Elfrid Payton, to me, is not going to be that guy. So they still need like an actual like star. But if they could get like a really good point guard, at least the theory of the team makes a lot more sense than it once did. But they still need those two pieces. They need that other combo forward, and they need a point guard who's really dynamic and can do something.
They're not good now. They're not good yet, but they're coherent, and that's a step. So, yay.
Yeah. And we don't even know if Aaron Gordon is that good yet. Hezonja, I mean, I think we're kind of leaving him out of their long-term plans at this point. And the Magic, in terms of cap space, had Ibaka left, they could have had about $28 million or so in space. Now that they've picked up Ross, they also have this additional first-round pick. They probably are looking at more like about $17, $18 million in space, something like that, if they really wanted to move on from CJ Watson, who's only guaranteed $1 million next year. And that might be enough to pick up a starter-ish level of player, though, as they've kind of established so far this year, they are really down in the pecking order in terms of free agency, despite the beautiful weather there. Let's move on to Toronto now. What does this do for them?
It gives them another possible answer at one of the biggest questions they've had. I mean, there is a significant portion of the first podcast we did in the 15 and 60 where mostly you, but both of us lamented just the fact that they were playing two traditional centers, and Serge Ibaka hopefully eliminates that need, both now and as long as they have him under contract.
By the way, it's possible that I may owe Dwayne Casey an apology for that, because maybe Powell and Ross were held out of the second half of that game because they knew that these talks were ongoing. So that's a possibility. I don't want to speculate too hard on that one, but maybe so. Sorry, continue on there. I wanted to at least maybe give Casey an out on that one, since I was killing him in the last podcast.
Sure. So Toronto now has a player who is incredibly talented at things that they actually need. He can space the floor and defend big man spots. Whether he's better at the four or the five is an open question, one that you and I have discussed at various moments in time. But he is a possible answer, and I wrote a piece for the Sporting News about this, where this trade is clearly made for the near term, just because he is an unrestricted free agent. They'll have bird rights, but they can do what they want. But it also gives Toronto a fascinating summer, because if they want to pay Ibaka and Lowry, which the presumption is that they will, that team is going to get very expensive, and it's going to be harder to move their existing salary and keep a competitive team. They can make it work. I'm not saying they can't, but it's going to be a challenge, and I'm excited to see how Masai Ujiri, one of the best GMs in the league, handles it.
Yeah, we could see them maybe trying to move salary in the offseason. Valanciunas, Damari Carroll, Corey Joseph, all those guys could potentially be expendable, but other than Joseph, might require an asset to move, although Valanciunas really is not making that much. It's just, again, for offense only ish centers, we've established that the market is not particularly impressive on the floor for the Raptors. I do think this is important, especially because in the near term, with Patrick Patterson being out and really his availability kind of iffy, as he's been in and out with this sore knee that's plagued him really, I think, for almost a month and a half now. They needed Ibaka to come right in and start. They're not going to be starting these terrible starting lineups anymore, which would be nice. They can get off to a much better start, still play Patterson down the end. And then I think the matchup of Ibaka and Patterson at the four and five is something that actually would finally give them some prayer of a chance of defending Cleveland. I think that they still have the problem of DeMar DeRozan, who is not a good defender, but other than that, and Carroll has his issues, but between Ibaka, Patterson, Carroll, and Lowry, you've got at least four pretty passable defenders. We'll see. I mean, Ibaka, I know he's dropped off this year. I think especially his lateral movement, his rim protection, not the same as it used to be, whether it's due to age or that surgery, but he's had a fabulous offensive season shooting the ball. He's probably even a more reliable three-point shooter at this point than Patterson is. And I think this is a good move for Toronto, especially because they don't give up anything that's that important. And this is really a testament here to improving their team like this, to the little moves. One of them is getting Norman Powell in the draft. Terrence Ross is not expendable. They would have nobody else as a backup wing if they hadn't got Norman Powell for dirt cheap in the 2015 draft. And then the pick that they sent, they have two picks, you know, now one of them is expendable. That's because they traded for that Clippers pick that was initially used to dump Jared Dudley. And then they traded Grievous Vasquez for that first round pick. And Vasquez basically like never played again after that, partially due to injury, but also it wasn't really any good. He only had 1 year left on his contract too at the time. If you think about flipping at for a year of Grievous Vasquez versus, you know, a playoffs and a half a year of Ibaka, you'll do that anytime.
This also has to be analyzed at least a little bit, though they didn't know it for sure, though they knew he had an injury, in the context of what's happening with Cleveland. You know, Kevin Love is missing some time, and now the top four in the East is way more fluid than we thought. And I think this is more of a move for the playoffs and to be viable in a series against any team. But the prospect of holding firm or moving up is certainly advantageous as well.
I think it's also not a coincidence that Mike Budenholzer came out in the media and said, you can print it, Paul Millsap will not be traded yesterday. And then they trade for Ibaka today.
There also weren't that many teams, especially if Boston doesn't want to trade their guys for a rental, which is a possibility. They've held firm on their guys other than that reported offer for the Kaminsky pick. And if they were there, then Orlando probably wasn't going to get much better of an offer, if a better offer at all than this. So why not pull the trigger now, avoid any risk of injury or inconsistency or whatever over the last couple games of the season before the break?
Yeah, and for teams that are really looking for someone who can protect the rim, which Ibaka still could do in theory, who can play some defense, you've noted before that there aren't really very many rim protectors available on the free agent market, and therefore there are a few rim protectors available on the trade market as well. Maybe Taj Gibson would be the next guy, but it seems like the Bulls still are not exactly trying to move him, even though he's been in trade rumors forever. Andrew Bogut might be the other guy, but he's got to actually get healthy. He hasn't been good this year when he has played, so that's another one. I don't think anybody is like really that excited about getting Bogut, who's going to make a difference as your starting center or something like that. So outside of that, it's really Willie Reed. Now you're down at like Willie Reed, Roy Hibbert land. If he like gets bought out or traded again, he can't be aggregated. And then Nerlens Noel would be the other guy, maybe Rashawn Holmes, but those guys are kind of young and untested. And, you'd actually would have to give up some pieces for them probably.
Assuming it theoretically came down to it, how would you feel comparing Taj Gibson and Serge Ibaka in terms of their fit for the Raptors? I like Ibaka much more.
Defensively, I think Gibson is better. I think he moves his feet better than, and he also actually provides a little bit of a post game, although he never passes it. Ibaka has done more posting up this year too, but offensively, the spacing that he provides, again, like playing Gibson at the four is basically like playing two centers together offensively, and that makes it kind of too difficult offensively as well. So I think Ibaka still, I prefer him over Gibson. And what we argued about Ibaka, which in the portion that I'll play later on, maybe he will be re-energized. Maybe he can bring a new level of effort. He certainly never really seemed into it defensively, other than the one game that the Magic won in Oklahoma City when he went back there.
And I like his fit with the Raptors in the sense that they can use him at both power forward and center, depending on need. They have enough talent when Patterson is healthy to float him between the two. And Toronto is going to need at some point in the near future, this year, the summer, another swingman, basically a fourth guy to kind of fill the role that Norman Powell has vacated to fill.
Yeah, they only have 1-3 on the roster, and that's Carroll, but they basically only had that already. And maybe they could still make another move. They probably aren't interested in going back on the James Johnson roller coaster again, but PJ Tucker is another guy. Maybe you could help them, although Tucker is more useful, I think, as a four. They really just need a pure three type of player. Someone like Danilo Gallinari could be it, although now their matching salary is a little uglier, and Carroll would probably have to be involved in any matching salary too. So I'm guessing the Raptors are probably done here. They just gotta hope to hell that Carroll holds up at this point. Otherwise, it's just gonna be Norm Powell at the three, and they still don't really have anyone who can guard LeBron at this point. So that's a problem, and Ibaka's rim protection is nice, but when you space him out so much, his ability to cover both the three-point line and the rim is waning by the day, it seems.
It's time for Bruno Caboclo.
Now we still got one more year for that. Let's get to the Cavs now. I think, we spent a lot of time on this Ibaka thing because it's more interesting. I think actually this news about Love could be significant. And at first, like, 4 to 6 weeks, even if it's 6 weeks, at the beginning of April, he'll be back for the playoffs. Doesn't usually, or at least a lot of times, it's not that simple.
It isn't. And and giving a little bit of wiggle room. I often use 20% as a buffer. You're getting really close to the start of the playoffs, and Cleveland will not have had their full strength starting five in months. Long time. And while they have played together before, this is not a first time figuring it all out. It is a big adjustment. And in many ways, the biggest part of this, if Kevin Love is back for the playoffs, because of course that's the caveat of this. If he's not, then that's the biggest part of this. And if he's not 100%, is how do they approach this in terms of LeBron James and his rest? Because he has played the most minutes in the league for a arguably limited return. And now if their goal is to stay competitive, they need LeBron more than they have in a long time.
Yeah, with I think the Raps now are 6 games behind Cleveland. I think they'd be hard pressed to pass Cleveland. We'll see how quickly Ibaka is able to integrate. But Boston, still a threat to Cleveland as well. Even the Wizards, although they have a road heavy schedule remaining, I wouldn't be too worried about seed if I were Cleveland. I think that LeBron getting some rest, he's got to be able to bring it defensively, have the energy in the playoffs. And same thing with Kyrie Irving too. Remember, it's got to be in somewhat of the same category, and he's coming off still a myriad of injuries. He's been incredibly healthy this year, but this will be the first healthy year of his career if he makes it all the way through, other than that hamstring that cost him a couple of games. With all that, yeah, I mean, I think they need to start kind of resting, chill out a little bit. Maybe if JR comes back, that'll help him. I mean, they're still scoring like crazy. And I still think that they, even if Love never plays another game for them this season, they're still the Eastern Conference favorites. Would you agree with that?
You mean including the playoffs?
Yes.
Yeah, I still think they are. It's tougher, but yeah, I still think they're the favorites.
Yeah, they could be a little more vulnerable, but I mean, you remember 2 years ago, obviously that was a much different Cavs team with less shooting, but a 2 years younger LeBron too. Although I think LeBron 2 years ago actually wasn't playing as well offensively as he is this year, because he's hitting his threes, assisting more. They've got so much more shooting around him, of course, as well. But they almost lost to a pretty flawed Bulls team in the second round without Kevin Love due out to that shoulder injury. And I think, though, I don't know if this cripples them too much, because if he isn't as effective, I don't think they need him in the East playoffs. And then, of course, in the finals, I don't think he really helps them that much against Golden State in more than, you know, 25 minutes a game, 20 minutes a game. But of course, certainly Cleveland will have an excuse if they do lose to the Warriors, that like Love was going to make some huge difference. So they at least Cleveland fans have that, right? If Love doesn't come back. But I think he's probably going to. Maybe he comes back at the beginning of April. Again, that 6-week timeline, is that's the outside of it. We talk again about arthroscopic surgery, 4 to 6 weeks. Pat Beverly, Blake Griffin came back. Jan Mahimi didn't. A lot of guys don't fit that timeline. It's a very similar timeline, actually, to Derrick Rose in 2015, where he basically came back, was able to play 5 games before the playoffs start, and he actually was pretty good in those 2015 playoffs compared to where he had been in the regular season. But all that said, I think there's a substantial likelihood that he's never quite right. And then you also throw in the fact that his knees are really rumored to be bad to begin with, and you wonder about him as a long-term asset. And you also wonder, I don't think this is going to happen because they've made so many public proclamations to the contrary, of whether it would make more sense now to trade for Carmelo Anthony and give up Kevin Love in the deal.
I was wondering if you were going to bring that up. From the Knicks' perspective, yeah, why not? I mean, they weren't about this year anyway. So trading for Kevin Love, you have the concerns about his knees long term, certainly. But you don't have that. The present doesn't cost them as much.
I mean, if I were the Knicks, I would be looking to flip Love again at some point pretty quickly.
Yeah, because I don't think he's the long term answer next to Porzingis. So sure, certainly. Right.
Well, he does help with their rebounding, at least. And I think offensively, it could be pretty nasty, those two in the front court. And maybe Porzingis, with Love next to him as a defensive rebounder, he concentrates on protecting the basket. You could see how maybe it would work a little bit. But yeah, I mean, I agree. Love is old enough now at 28, where it's probably not the greatest partnership. But as someone who is probably the furthest along as far as, hey, would it make sense to trade Anthony for Love? Not, of course. I mean, I don't want to discount this. I'm just saying, in a pure basketball Machiavellian sense, not the, hey, we finally got Kevin Love to buy in, he wanted to come here, we traded for him, and now we're going to dump him, and that doesn't make us look very good, especially since LeBron called everyone trash who wrote that he wanted Love traded for Melo. That kind of sense, maybe it doesn't work. But in a pure basketball sense, I would be thinking more and more about it if I were Cleveland.
I was just thinking about Love and Horford together. I don't think Boston does that trade right now, but in July, that would be interesting.
Yeah, Love could also help with their defensive rebounding problems as well. I think Boston would want to, because Love, of course, has these defensive limitations that are only going to get worse, Boston would want to see, again, what was out there. Because essentially, if Boston trades for anybody, Johnson and Zeller are going to be in the deal because as matching salary, and then they basically lose all their cap space. They're getting their cap space.
That's why for me, I think it's a July trade, not a February trade.
Right, exactly. Yeah, if they strike out in free agency, maybe he's the best they can do, and they're going to lose all their space the next year anyway, so you might as well just get someone. But even if it's a July trade, I guess he would just go right into their cap space is what it would have to be.
Right, or you could have some filler salary if you needed to. Yeah, depending on where they were, you could throw a little bit back depending on what was in the trade. But yeah, it's too far field to go too far into it. But
yeah, and also the Cavs trading with their main rival in the East seems a little unlikely as well. But
well, no, that's why I'm saying they would make the trade with the Knicks, and then the Knicks would move. The Knicks would move him because Love is not on their timeline.
Yeah, that sounds too smart for the Knicks.
You're right.
All right, I think. So we will move on here. We've got some other news to get to. And then we also have the rest of the 15 and 60, slightly out of date, but hopefully still worth listening to for a couple of teams, but chock full of other nuggets for everything else. So we'll be back right after this break. So if you're like me, you may have heard of Stamps.com on a ton of other podcasts, but I never understood just how useful it could be until they got in touch with me about advertising on the podcast. I don't really care for the post office. I have to go there pretty often just to mail stuff out for the podcast, packages, especially if I'm returning stuff that I bought online, like clothes that doesn't fit me, which given my dimensions happens pretty often for me. And a lot of times I would just kind of languish and delay going to the post office because I knew in my town, if I got there, it was going to be like a 20-minute wait to just go and send a package. With Stamps.com, you can do anything that you can do at the post office. You can print postage on anything. You can just put mail in the mail slot, send it out to your letter carrier. That's something I actually didn't know you could do until pretty recently. Instead of having to go to a mailbox, you can schedule a free U.S. Postal Service pickup if you have a larger package. Anything you can do at the post office, you can do at homes now with Stamps.com. And what's more, you can save money with postage discounts for priority mail, first class international mail. Because of the volume of Stamps.com, they can pass those discounts on to you. The sign up was exceedingly easy. It took me less than 5 minutes. You don't need any special hardware. All you do, you just print out a shipping label. If you want to, then just tape it on. Go ahead and schedule that pickup, and you can mail back things like that shirt you bought that doesn't fit instead of letting it just sit around because you don't want to go to the post office and spend an hour between driving there and waiting in line to send it back. And with the special discounts from Stamps.com, you can save up to 50% on sending packages. If you're a small business owner, even better than if you're just kind of a small fry like me, those discounts can really add up, as can the ease of just making your computer your post office. So right now, use the code CAPSPACE at Stamps.com. Go to the upper right, there's a microphone, put in the code CAPSPACE. You can get a 4-week trial, including postage and a digital scale. They're willing to give you that offer because people like Stamps.com so much that they end up sticking with it. So make sure before you do anything else, when you go to Stamps.com, click on that radio microphone, enter in that CAPSPACE code that you remember because we talk about it all the time in the program. That's Stamps.com, enter code CAPSPACE, Stamps.com, never go to the post office again. Okay, now let's continue on with the 15 and 60. If you missed the first half, you can go back to listen to that. Also, we talked about the Plumlee-Nurkic trade between Denver and Portland in the first one. We're going to start off tonight with the Cleveland Cavaliers and do every team after that except for Detroit and Toronto. They were in the first edition. And we also first, though, have some news to get to. Before that, however, I want to let you know that we are sponsored today by a new sponsor, Stamps.com, something you've probably heard a lot about on other podcasts, but after I'm now familiar with their service, there's actually a lot of new things that I want to tell you about that you may not have heard about them, a good reason to use their service. The way to get started with them, enter the CAPSPACE code on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and you can get a free 4-week trial, including postage and a digital scale. And also betterment.com/CAPSPACE. You can get up to 6 months of no fees for lower cost automated investing. Let's start with some news though here, Danny. What we got?
Well, we already talked about the trade of Monday morning with Birdman going to the Hornets for cap relief. So my personal one that I want to start with is Dragan Bender, just because he was a high pick in the draft, a guy that I was a big fan of, and had, I believe he had ankle surgery, and so he's out about 4 to 6 weeks.
Yeah, had basically some bone spurs that needed to be cleaned up. He had a sprained ankle, attempted to return, was unable to do so, and now he's having the surgery. Too bad, really, because it would be nice to see him get some more development time. I think he should be ahead of Marquise Chris in their rotation. That Earl Watson obviously does not agree with that, but this, by the time he comes back, the year is going to kind of be over, and it would have been nice to see once they, I mean, I think they kind of still are thinking they're sort of in it, which they're not, but once they really embraced the development, not to say that they haven't that much already, that Bender maybe could have done a little bit more than just stand in the corner and shoot three-pointers, which is all he's been asked to do lately. But so a shame to see that that happened for the Sacramento Kings. Garrett Temple and Omri Caspi both out through the All-Star break with hamstring and calf injuries, respectively. Caspi has been struggling with that calf injury for a while. The Kings have actually been playing okay without Caspi and without Rudy Gay. Temple, more important really to what they're doing, though. This will be maybe one last chance for Ben McLemore to build some value, though, before he gets into restricted free agency.
Per our friend Sam Amick, Magic wants to call the shots for the Lakers and has been studying up on the CBA, which is very exciting. And, you know, that does give us sign, along with some of the other reporting that's been out there. I believe Ramona Shelburne had some on this as well, about where the Lakers and Jeannie Buss might be going from here.
Yeah, Ramona, that's the spin on that one seemed to be a little bit more wait and see. We'll give Jim Buss a chance. Maybe we're just going to evaluate everyone. Let's see what Magic wants to do. And then since then, you know, with Kevin Ding's reporting, and this one actually from Josh Peter, Sam tweeted it out. I pasted that in there, but Josh Peter was the one who actually had the interview. Magic does want to call the shots. He is, at least he's talking about learning stuff about the CBA. He also says that he knows about evaluating players and he's good at evaluating players. I would not much in his public record has really indicated that that's the case either, but you know, maybe if he really puts the work in, he can get to that point. I'm prejudging him, but I don't want to completely dismiss the possibility that he might be able to get there. In other news, Briante Weber got a second 10-day contract, was reported with the Warriors, was reported by Chris Haynes that there was interest from four other teams for Weber. We had speculated that maybe they would wait around the All-Star break to bring him in, but with Sean Livingston again missing some time due to the birth of his kid, Klay Thompson out with the heel injury, they decided they needed to bring him back immediately. Real quickly, what have you thought of what we've seen of him so far as our resident Golden State Warriors expert?
He's looked good.
You thought I was going to say Homer there, didn't you?
No, I didn't, because you know that I would go through the screen and just choke you. But
I know. I have this nice new big monitor, so both breaking the monitor and also giving you a lot of room to come through the screen. So that would be negative.
I think he's looked good, more so defensively than offensively. He's very aggressive in passing lanes and does a nice job. He had a little bit of time today playing backup point guard with the second unit and looked fine, but not great there. But certainly worth giving a chance to, and I think he's looked better than the guys that I expect to get bought out who are point guards, so why not roll the dice with him?
He's just a monster defensively. We've talked about that. Doesn't want to shoot at all on offense, but he can at least. He has the quickness to penetrate and drive and kick. But yeah, I mean, he is shooting as an absolute last resort, even when he plays with the rest of the garbage time unit. We talked about how Bud said that Paul Millsap is not going anywhere. You can write that. Chris Fillmore had that story. And Alex Martins, CEO of the Magic, perhaps a little bit more controversial than you might want to have for that sort of an executive in his history, he said that Rob Hennigan's performance is to be evaluated after the season, just like every staffer's performance is evaluated. This is another one of those ones, as you mentioned, where it might have been nice to make the move before the trade deadline, and now it seems like they at least are willing to acknowledge with Serge Ibaka, whom we'll talk about more in the 15 and 60, that it may not make sense to retain him and that they should try to move on from him if they can get something for him. But certainly, I mean, you can't put all of their issues since the Howard trade on Hennigan, and I thought in the Howard trade itself, he actually managed to do pretty well despite maybe some of the appearances at the time. But then, I mean, some of the moves that they've made since then, perhaps in part due to ownership or Martin's interference themselves. But if you just look at the Magic's record and their transactions since then, hard to make an argument at this point that Hennigan should be retained.
They have sold low on an appalling number of players, especially young players on reasonable contracts. And you can't survive that, whether it was ownership or the GM. Either way, just to save face, you need somebody different there.
For Indiana, they were really on a roll. And then Thad Young came down with a wrist injury. He did not play against the Spurs tonight. He is not supposed to return prior to the All-Star break. And did they win tonight against the Spurs? I didn't see that yet.
They lost by four. They had the lead for the most part, and then the Spurs just came back late and pushed it.
Joakim Noah has already missed, I think, five games now with a hamstring injury. Remember that he missed most of training camp with the hamstring as well. And we really hadn't seen Noah's injuries be a huge issue yet this year. It's just basically been ineffectiveness. But that's allowed Willy Hernan Gomez to get into the starting lineup. He's looked okay. We'll talk a little bit more about him coming up here as we talk about that Spurs-Knicks game from a couple of days ago that I watched extensively as part of the Twitter NBA show Second Screen. We'll be taking submissions if we want to call it something other than Second Screen, but that's what it's called for now. So, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's probably better for the Knicks if he doesn't play, frankly. I mean, unless you have some hopes that he could rebuild his value enough to get traded, and that seems rather unlikely.
Yeah, and you ready to move, ready to do the Cavs? Actually, I think we have some other stuff to talk about, too.
Yeah, we do. Last thing, though, in terms of notes, Kenneth Faried, he sprained his ankle. He's out through the All-Star break. Emmanuel Mudiay continuing to struggle with a back injury. He tried to come back and play one game, and you have to imagine that he is also out through the break as well. All right, let's get started with the Cleveland Cavaliers, who have righted the ship of late after a bit of panic.
37-16, 8-6 since the last time we did this, though, as you said, that includes some of the pre-writing of the ship. Fourth in offense, 20th in defense, plus 4.3 net rating. 538 gives them a 66% chance of getting the top seed in the East, 9% chance of winning the championship, and projects them to finish first in the East and fourth in the NBA with 56 wins.
Yeah, we talked about the Birdman trade yesterday when we discussed the Hornets. They saved $2.5 million in luxury tax via that transaction, had to ship out about $700,000 in cash. I wanted to look at how they've done over their last 10 games when they've started playing better. The defense has not particularly improved. 108 defensive rating with their main guys on the floor, but a 119 offensive rating. So they've just been killing teams on offense, basically, has been how they've gotten back to it. And that's just what they're going to do, basically, to everyone. I looked a little bit at how Derek Williams has looked for them. McMenamin reporting that he's already done enough to earn LeBron's trust and get another 10-day. I was surprised to look and see that really he only played, had 12 possessions and 19 points through Monday. He's been effective as a cutter and finisher. LeBron has been looking for him. He's only hit 1 3-pointer, though. He's dropped a couple of LeBron passes out of bounds, that cross-court passes that should have been open threes. But he's been good coming off of screens and back cutting. Gets out in transition a lot. He could be an effective transition finisher. Not going to help your defense. I mean, I think he's going to be a guy to give them another body who can just help fuel the offensive machine. Absolutely, I think he can do that. Can he be an effective player in the playoffs, especially as someone who has no playoff experience? I am more skeptical.
Oh, but his defense is really going to ratchet up in the playoffs.
Yeah. Well, do you buy that for Cleveland? I mean, they're 20th in defense now. Can they do it again? Can they get their defense where it needs to be? Their defense wasn't even that good in the East playoffs. Toronto had some games where they ran wild on them. They just overwhelmed Toronto with their offense. And then, yeah, they had like four real good games in the finals against the Warriors defensively.
I think LeBron can do it for five games and that's enough.
Yeah, that's what it is, right? It's all LeBron playing better. And Kyrie too. I mean, he, like in that game against the Wizards that they won in ridiculous fashion on the road a week ago, Kyrie actually, like when he really bucked up in isolation, he had some success guarding John Wall, guarding Beal. It's just over the course of an entire game, over the course of an entire season, that he doesn't bring the effort. Maybe he can get to the point where, you know, 4 out of 7 games, they can play good defense, but we'll see. I mean, that was not, that Warriors team was not the offense that they had been earlier in the season and not the offense I expect them to be in this year's finals. But I do think there's certainly something to the idea that they have a higher level than what they've shown so far in this regular season. I think that's very clear.
And in kind of an unusual sequence of events, just on the way this often turns out, Chris Haynes and Dave McMenamin had a report that J.R. Smith is ahead of schedule and could be back in 3 weeks when it was originally projected for mid-March. And J.R. Smith denied that on Twitter, including saying, trust my process or something like that. So either way, what's really important for J.R. is just that he's back for the playoffs. Being back for a month certainly would help, but we'll see.
Yeah, and he also, of course, has that family issue going on with the premature birth of his child. Mm-hmm. So that could be another complicating factor there as well. Channing Frye is getting to the point. I thought he was an effective defender, underrated defender earlier in his career, has not really been able to be a positive force. And at his age, that's not a surprise. Defensively, he certainly helps the offense with his shooting. And he doesn't have any other defenders around him, especially on some of those second units that he plays on. But he might be getting now, especially against really good competition, where his bad defense could be outweighing the offense, especially if he has to go against frontline guys. If he's playing against bench units in the playoffs, maybe it looks a little bit better.
I'm not as concerned about it, but it's certainly is something that you're sitting on the back line because they just don't have that many other options. You know, like they're not at a place where they can just throw somebody else out there. They're at their limit.
Yeah, you mentioned before that Oklahoma City is one of these teams that kind of bores you just from an intellectual standpoint. And I feel the same way about the Cavs, just in terms of not really having that much to learn about them. And I guess one thing you could point to is that LeBron is shooting 37% on threes this year. And he's also shooting like some unbelievable percentage, like over 50% on threes in the clutch. And then Kyrie is like 5 out of 22 or something on threes in the clutch, despite that like crazy fadeaway on the right wing that he made in overtime against Washington. So if LeBron can still hit his three-pointers, it makes him much more difficult to guard for good defensive teams, of which they will face zero in the Eastern Conference playoffs.
Yeah, especially with Boston not being what we thought they might be on the defensive end.
Right, yeah, we hoped that they would be a top five defense, and that clearly has not materialized. Let's move on to the Indiana Pacers.
Pacers, another success story of the last little bit. 29-26, 13-8 since the last time we did this. 14th
in
offense.
And that's with this recent slide too, with Young being out. They really were on fire before that.
They were. They pushed themselves clearly into the playoff picture. 14th in offense, 16th in defense, a slight negative 0.5 net rating, 81% chance of making the playoffs per 538, projected to be 6th in the East with 41 wins.
They've really missed Thaddeus Young lately, and part of it is also just that they have nothing approximating a replacement. They don't have another four really on the roster who's remotely playable. And wait, so
originally that was what was killing, part of what was killing their second unit. Now it's killing their starters.
Yeah, right. And Lavoy Allen, Kevin Serafin, and Al Jefferson all have negative 7 or lower net ratings on the season. Over the last 15 games, Allen has played more minutes than Serafin or Big Al. He's actually been starting at the four, and he's been in the positive. But I think a lot of that is just that he's been playing with the rest of their starters instead of their crappy bench. I guess he's the best option. Like, of those three guys, he's the best option for actually being able to guard fours. I wanted to ask you, though, they have to decide before free agency begins whether they would pick up his team option, which is for about $4 million next year. Would you do that, or would you let him walk at this point? And maybe you could always hope to re-sign him potentially. You'd have full bird rights on him, but he could also go elsewhere.
I'm okay with a $4 million rental for him. It's in the new cap that's below the mid-level exception, and I don't think Indiana's cap space is that valuable. If they had
he's an adequate fourth big. I guess the only problem is that they already have Al Jefferson on the roster, and how much you want to tie up in some of these like slow, immobile bigs who really should only be playing center. But yeah, it just, in a vacuum, he's a decent enough value as a guy who can be on the court and not kill you and make $4 million a year. That's what those guys cost these days.
They're also not going to have that many avenues to get better. They have their draft pick. I don't think they have any surplus moving forward, but circumstances could change beyond that. And as you said, he doesn't add a wrinkle to them, really. He's just a solid big. And if that's what they're looking for, while I said there isn't much on the market, they're always those type of guys.
There is one thing to consider, though. CJ Miles has a player option. I imagine he's going to opt out of that for 4.7. Assuming he does that, you keep Jeff Teague's cap hold of $13 million on the books. Now they have about $13 million in space. And I think the difference between being able to offer a $13 million contract and a $17 million contract, I think that's actually pretty big. So that might actually be a reason why they might want to move on from him and just hope to re-sign him, maybe with cap space. I mean, who knows how big an offer he's going to get. yet, but they'll have bird rights on him. And, you know, if they could even end up having to pay a tax on that and bring him back for more. But that $4 million could make the difference between getting another starter, you know, and then they're going to have a gaping hole at the two now with Monte Ellis. They finally have realized that he's a bench guy for them. So they're desperately going to need a two, and the $17 million can get you a quality starter at the two. And I'm not sure that $13 million can't. So that'll be an interesting decision for Larry Bird and company to make.
Once they follow our lead and get JJ Redick in that trade, then they won't have to worry about it.
They will at least know. Oh, actually, they also, if they wanted to, CJ Miles has a deadline of June 20th to exercise his player option, but the team could actually waive him before that if they want to. I wouldn't do that if I were them, because I think he's quite a solid value at $4.7 million, and he's been starting at the two. But they do have that option if they really want to make sure that they're not going to have to pay him. But again, making that decision so early on, I don't see how you think you're going to do better than him. And he might, you know, if he's probably going to opt out anyway, so it wouldn't be an issue. I don't see, unless he gets hurt, I wouldn't see any reason why you would want to waive him at that point. Yeah, that'll be an interesting discussion of like what twos they might be able to get. And they're still going to need, you know, a backup four who can actually play a little bit too. A couple of other notes here. Jeff Teague having a very underrated season at this point, perhaps because he just started off really terribly. And that narrative just kind of stuck in people's minds. And you go back and check now, and he's been good.
He has been. And you worry a little bit because he'll turn 29 this summer. And he's not small in terms of height, but he's just a little bit on the small side to me. But 35% on threes, he's getting to the free throw line and is orchestrating their offense. I mean, they're 14th there, which isn't, I don't think that's bad considering their personnel. It's not great.
Well, and considering how bad their bench is offensively, too. If
right.
They, like the when he's been in the game and when the stars have been in the game, they've been very effective.
Yeah, so they've had a nice year with him. He's very, very different from George Hill, for better or for worse, but I fully expect them to re-sign him this summer.
Yeah, you have to imagine that. How are we feeling about the Hill for Teague trade at this point? Hill has been better than him on both ends, I think, so far, but Hill has also missed half the season, and Teague, I think, has actually played slightly better than I thought that he might.
Them moving off of Monte made that so much more palatable, because a lot of my concern was just that backcourt would have been a disaster, and it was a disaster early in the year, but playing Glenn Robinson III, playing CJ Miles in that two-guard spot works so much better.
Yeah, that's another one of those times, like with that David Lee injury that brought in Draymond Green, where I think Monte's injury, whether they wanted an excuse or they finally realized that he shouldn't be starting at the two, either way, that Green injury had where he missed like 3 weeks has really been a boon for them, frankly.
Something you brought up that I thought was interesting was the idea of them adding bench players through a trade this year. They have some flexibility to make that work, and they value their draft picks. They very rarely trade them, but if they could make a move with Miami for a couple of those guys, like the moves that we were exploring in the mock deadline for so much time, I think it could help them a lot.
I don't know if that's actually true. I mean, they traded away the pick for Caris LeVert, and I guess he wasn't a draft pick, but they traded away Plumlee and Luis Scola, and I think a first-round pick. Or maybe they got back school. I can't remember what they did. But I want to say they traded away a first-round pick to Phoenix to dump salary a couple of years ago when they were like looking, getting pretty close to the tax. So,
yeah, I guess I was just thinking about that time. I think it was about a year ago, but it was before the Thad Young trade for sure, where they had all of their own picks and nobody else's picks. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Might be one of those anchoring moments.
Yeah, I think they would be a great candidate to trade for James Johnson. He could give them exactly what they need on the second unit as a small ball four who can defend. He's been hitting his shots this year. You know, I don't know, wouldn't want to give up more than a second rounder. And they do have that weird issue that we talked about in the mock trade deadline where their first rounder is encumbered. I think the next 3 years,
their second
it's
rounder.
Reverse. Second rounder, yes, thank you. It's reverse protected 31 to 44. So if it's not in the lottery, which it's not going to be this year, then it ends up going on a couple years out. They could trade the part that's not protected, but does anyone want a second round pick that's you know, going to be probably beyond 45 guaranteed? You know, that's not that great. And I don't know, you know, maybe someone like Glenn Robinson III could have some value for the Heat, but they don't have a ton in the way of prospects that they could trade either. And a first rounder is too much to give up for someone like Johnson or really anybody who's going to be a rental that they would be in the market for.
I think we're ready to move on to the Heat, James Johnson's current team.
24-32, 13-2 since we last did this. 26th ranked offense, but 6th ranked defense. Negative 1.1 net rating, which is actually still better. And they finally have had some luck in close games after just getting killed in that 11-30 start. And they have a 30% chance of making the playoffs, projected for 36 wins, right on the cusp with all these other flotsam teams.
In their last 15 games, so that's the 13-game win streak in the 2 cents, they have a plus 7.5 net rating. But the problem there is that it's fueled by this ridiculous offense. They had scored 109.4 points per 100 possessions, which feels like an outlier.
And it is an outlier because Deion Waiters has been on fire lately, shooting 43% on three-pointers. I mean, anyone who saw that Warriors game where he lit them up knows that his performance has been unsustainable. Still can't make a shot at the rim during this period, but also shooting 44% on long twos, and he's taken a ton of those as well. And then just their team in general over that time, 58% true shooting, 41% on threes. This team does not have the type of shooters to go 41% on threes. I think that would be an NBA record, at least for the non 22-foot three-point line era.
Something I wanted to discuss is there's been a little bit, I believe Mark Stein had a comment on it in his, I think it was his Weekend Dime piece, about them being interested in Serge Ibaka. And speaking solely for myself, I think that makes no sense for Miami. He is best as a center. We've seen a lot of defensive struggles in Orlando, and he's about to get properly paid. They can just sign him as a free agent if they want it, and Orlando's not going
to
give him more.
He's about to get improperly paid. Yeah,
that's a good point.
He's about to get overpaid, yeah.
And so, or they have the cap space if they wanted to sign him, and Orlando, considering the realistic nature of their situation, that Hennigan's their GM, he's the one who traded for Ibaka, Miami's not going to get him for a song. They're going to actually have to pay for him, and I don't think them pushing to make the playoffs this year is even a good thing.
Well, who are they even going to trade for Ibaka? Because they cannot trade a first rounder until 2023 at this point, because their 2018 and their 2021 picks are encumbered. That means you can't trade 19 or 20, because that would mean trading a pick 2 years in a row. They could maybe throw some swap rights in there or something if they wanted to, but so it really would have to be some of these young prospects that they would trade, and I'm not sure who that'd be. Maybe they would also be able to get Orlando to take a Josh McRoberts dead salary as well, in addition to sending one of these prospects out to Orlando. But and it's not like Miami has these awesome shooters who are laying around. That's really what Orlando needs, are awesome playmakers that are laying around either.
It would really hurt if they traded Josh Richardson in a trade for Serge Ibaka, because we both really like Josh Richardson. And
yeah, it's been a lost year for him with all these injuries. I mean,
he doesn't make sense on the Magic either. Yeah. Like, he doesn't solve their problems.
I mean, he can at least shoot a little bit, so he might there. Right. But he's been out for like almost a month and a half now with this latest foot injury, after having that MCL, grade 2 MCL sprain early on in training camp. He missed all that, so it's been a lost year for him, lost year for Winslow. I mean, that's really, while the Heat have played great and they deserve all the credit in the world for their defense, that's really, I think, that great defensive rating they've had over that win streak, I think that is sustainable with the talent that they have, and more importantly their cohesion with Spo and their effort level. But in terms of the long-term plan, their two biggest prospects that they probably wanted to see development from this year were Richardson and Winslow, and both of them have had lost years due to injury.
Yeah, maybe if they can do Luke Babbitt for Ibaka, we'll make a deal work.
Let's talk about Goran Dragic's unbelievable season.
It's been awesome. And he's the linchpin of what they've been able to do offensively in this run. But overall for the season, 58% true shooting, 26% usage, and just the absolute orchestrator for them. And some of the times when he's been, you know, had a shaky night, or when they've been a little bit off, but that hasn't happened very much since New Year's, basically.
The big thing for him is he's shooting 44% on three-pointers, and he's had some ridiculous games. I think he was like, you know, 7-for-8 from three, and some 33-point performance that they had recently. That's up from 31% last year. You know, he's never shot 40% before. I think he was up in the high 30s a couple times in Phoenix, but presumably his looks last year were easier when he was playing off the ball more. But I do think that his performance this year validates something that we were saying a lot of last year, which is that he's actually a better offensive player than Dwayne Wade. And Wade was, you know, 51% true shooting last year. He had the ball in his hands all the time, especially in the clutch. Wade was awesome in the clutch last year in the playoffs too, but overall they would just completely relegate Dragic to the sideline and put the ball in Wade's hands, and I felt like they should have given more of that load to Dragic. The one concern for Dragic, down to 61% at the rim. You remember he used to just be this incredible plastic man finisher at the rim, shooting in the high 60s, even over 70% sometimes. It's just subjectively, doesn't quite have the burst anymore, gets bothered a little bit more by shot blockers than he used to. But it's also worth noting that this is probably the least spacing he's ever played with on a team as well. They do not have the shooters, despite this like crazy. I mean, if you were going to tell me that they would shoot 41% over any 15 game stretch this year with the guys they have, that would be shocking to me. But still, again, it's not going to continue. But I still think this team, they're right. They got as good a chance of the playoffs as any of these other teams.
They do. And this is one of only 2 years where they have really control over their pick in the near term because of those weird obligations moving forward and the protections and everything like that. So I get why they want to push at Spo. Their defense has been great. You run the offense as long as you can. But the long-term vision of this is it's not fool's gold because they have talent, but taking the patient approach, it just makes it so much harder to reach the heights long-term that they want to reach.
Yeah, and they have lost two straight, but really only time to lose one more game before the trade deadline. And so it's going to be really hard for Pat Riley to trade a bunch of these guys under Eric Spoelstra's nose. It does not send the right cultural message to this team. And they, of course, pride themselves on that. All right, we'll move on to the Milwaukee Bucks. But first, this from Betterment. The appeal of Betterment is that it's automated investing, so it's lower cost than more traditional financial services. The idea is that instead of trusting a specific person who may or may not be more competent than the average market, you can trust Betterment's advanced advice algorithms and beautiful user interface. They're built on smarter, cutting-edge technology. One of their products that I've heard about is Smart Deposit, because idle cash actually loses value. Smart Deposit can take money off the top of your checking account. You set a certain limit, and anything above there, it'll take it out and invest it for you. So especially if you're a freelancer or there's an irregular income, something like that, that's what that product is designed for. This is a great time to get started with Betterment to save for your retirement or any other financial goals, a house, getting married, something like that. Dunktown listeners can get up to 6 months of no fees at betterment.com/capspace. That's a URL, betterment.com/capspace, Betterment, investing made better. Oh, well, Jabari, of course, is out now for 12 months. We talked about that on a Twitter NBA show over the weekend. But at least we have Thon Maker now, Danny.
We do. And Maker has been fascinating. I mean, 15 to 27 from three. The possibility of him being a stretch five is interesting. And we don't know exactly what he'll be on the defensive end. So, yeah, I mean, you're looking more to the future now. We hope that this was going to be a present year with how they started. And there's still some fungibility in the whole thing, but at least there are encouraging signs.
Yeah, granted, still a very small sample, but he has been starting at center. He's basically played all of his real minutes in non-garbage time at center. He is 24 points on 13 pick and pops. Pretty much every single one of those is a jump shot. And if he could be a center and make a pick and pop jumper from three, which a lot of these are, that's really, really difficult to guard as a center. Hasn't been as effective on spot ups. I've liked his ability to move around, find the angles, and get dunks inside. He's not incredibly explosive. That's something that has never been the case for him. But he's got enough length that he can be an effective finisher. He had one nice finish in the film that I watched where he was able to bounce off Aaron Baines and finish on a dump off, even though Baines was in good position for verticality. Still very skinny, but I like that kid is willing to try him out at center. He's not going to finish games. That's going to be Greg Monroe, especially with Plumlee out of town. But I like that he's playing more than Henson, who they have not really been effective with Henson on the floor this year. And I mean, I think the biggest thing for Thon is, you know, that jump shot looks real. And I've been a believer in that. I saw him for the first time when he was in high school over in Europe at the Adidas Euro Camp in 2014. And he had a great jumper then. And I think that's always really kind of been the case. And I think he's got a good enough turnaround at some point where he can get into the post against switches. I do have to push back a little bit. I respect Howard Beck's work a lot. But one of the things that he talked about was, again, going back to these these mixtapes that Thon had and how he's got like this great crossover and that's like part of the appeal there. He's not going to do that. He's not going to drive to the basket one-on-one against guys. He doesn't create a ton of separation. If he does, it's going to be for a jump shot. He is not fast enough to get all the way to the rim. Doesn't have the explosion off of 1 foot to go over, finish over help at the rim. Not really a great passer either. Like, looking at him as someone who's going to create with the ball in his hands, like, I would be shocked if that's ever what he becomes. But as a really awesome role player who can block some shots, move his feet, switch, make jump shots, not get killed because he's not strong enough, all that's really good stuff if he can become a little bit, if he can continue to develop, I should say.
There are some basic threshold tests with big men ball handling. And I saw Maker in high school at a different time than you did. I saw him when he played up at Prolific Prep in 2016. And his handle is good for a guy his size, but a good handle for a guy his size does not mean you're going to be able to drive to the basket.
Yeah. I mean he's not going anywhere on these moves. He's not creating separate. I mean, he could just do a bunch of dribbling around cones, but and not lose the ball, but he's slow.
He can grab and go sometimes. I think that he could do that a little bit, but you can move the ball faster if it's not in his hand.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you've said that before. I even disagree with you on that. I don't think he even could do that.
I think he can. I mean, he's not as good at that seamless as Jokic, and he doesn't make as good decisions, but you could be, you know, like the 75% Jokic and do okay.
Let's talk a little bit about some of their other issues. Michael Beasley has been starting in Jabari's absence. He went crazy tonight on the Pistons. Apparently, the Bucks are just a terrible matchup for Detroit because the Bucks blew them out again. Beasley, surprisingly, has only taken 36 three-pointers on the year, but he's still been effective. He's just been scoring a lot on those two. But despite the fact that Beasley has been effective in his way, Mirza Teletovic has to play more for them. He is by far the best net rating on the team at 7.0, 18.6 net rating over their last 15 in 170 minutes, as the rest of their team has just been awful. They've been in this huge slide. You mentioned 4-11 in their last 15. He just got to play more, and I guess he will now with Jabari being out, but he's only shooting 35% on threes, and some people are like, oh, like, what's the point of him? He's not making his threes. But he just spaces the floor so much for everyone else. They don't have anyone else who does that.
He also has a history of making his threes, so you don't think that that's permanent.
Yeah, they guard him. Right.
So I don't think we talked about this as much at the beginning, but right now 538 has them at a 36% chance of making the playoffs, has them projected to be ninth in the East. While we expect them to drop off without Jabari, how far do you think they're going to drop off?
A lot depends on Middleton. I haven't had a chance to watch and see where Middleton is. And I think there's an argument that while Jabari was a great scorer, they were getting killed with him on the floor during the stretch until he hurt his ACL, especially when he was on the floor without Giannis. There's still a solid argument that with Middleton's defense and his floor spacing, not as good of a one-on-one guy as Jabari, doesn't have the potential, but that at his peak, he's better than what Jabari was doing this year. So if he can get back to that level, it's possible that they could improve where their performance was. You know, losing Plumlee, that's not the end of the world. Looks like Hawes and Hibbert, I don't think, have even played for them yet, and hopefully they won't. And, you know, you could even see those guys potentially getting bought out. That might be something actually that they could consider, especially with Hawes. Maybe just get, you know, if you could get a $3 million discount off of that $6 million that he's owed next year and buy him out, maybe that would be something that they could consider. And then if they just stretch that $3 million, it's only $1 million, you're fine there. I think they could start playing better. It wouldn't shock.
They've also gotten that weird mojo in terms of their point guard rotation where they've been absolutely smoked a lot of times, not tonight, but when Dellavedova has been on the floor. And Brogdon has been okay. He's kind of been that, but that's because they've changed his role around.
Yeah, I mean, they still have been effective when he's been on the floor, even in this stretch with a 2.8 net rating, still shooting over 40% on threes for the year. So I was thinking, I hadn't looked at it that, oh, they went through this tough stretch. Brogdon was probably over his head. He's not playing as well. That hasn't really been the case so far. All right, should we move on to the New York Knickerbockers?
Let's do it. They're 23-33, 5-10 since last time we did this, 15th in offense, 24th in defense, negative 3.3 net rating. 538 gives them a 6% chance of making the playoffs, projects them to finish 12th in the East with 33 wins.
Yeah, I think they improved that from 3% after beating the Spurs on Sunday. That was a game that I watched intently as part of the Twitter NBA show second screen experience. I had a few observations there. I watched Kristaps Porzingis very closely, especially on defense. I thought that he actually showed more ability to get down into a defensive stance and move his feet than we've seen before. I thought he did a pretty decent job guarding Davis Bertans when he was in there, had to guard him. Bertans is a knockdown shooter. So that was very encouraging. That's not something that we've seen a lot of from him. On the other hand, and granted, I don't know exactly how many games it's been since he came back from that Achilles soreness, but there are times in this game where he just looked exhausted. And he looked exhausted like early on. Like he came out of a timeout in the fourth quarter and like two possessions up and down, and he like couldn't even stand up. He was over on his knees, breathing really heavily. And so it may be the case that he needs to get into a little bit better a cardio shape, because we haven't seen a lot of those effort plays from him, especially the tip dunks. Granted, he's out by the three-point line more, but he hasn't been getting on the offensive glass at all. We just would need to see him making more of a difference in some of the effort categories.
Something that I'm monitoring, I haven't really developed an opinion on it yet, is that the Knicks are only rebounding defensively 74.1% of opponent misses when Porzingis is on the floor. It's identical with him off, so they just kind of suck as a defensive rebounding team. And the concern of that is that he's playing power forward next to true centers, and while that diminishes his offensive rebound percentage, if you play a 7'3" guy in a true center, you should be getting a lot of defensive rebounds. And it's a concern overall, but I need to watch more of them to see whether I put that on his shoulders or the other guys they have.
Yeah, and Porzingis, excellent 44% shooting allowed at the rim when he defends shots. Would like to see him defend more shots, only defending about 7 per game, and that's because he's had to be out on the perimeter more. And while he's slow afoot, Noah and Hernan Gomez and Kyle O'Quinn, the guys he's frequently paired with, are worse. So maybe, again, getting him to just get to where he can be good enough defensively at center, and getting the personnel to where you're not getting killed by having crappy wings around him or playing at the four if he has to play center. I mean, I think he still could be an elite defensive center at some point, because just his length is such an impediment. Whether he's coming out of nowhere or just if he's in the vicinity, guys really feel him a lot. I thought overall in this game against the Spurs, I was shocked at how well the Knicks defended. I think part of that is because the Spurs really just don't move the ball around all that much anymore. And Carmelo, I thought, did a pretty decent job on Kawhi. Courtney Lee did a pretty good job on Kawhi as well, even though he went off. I thought that they did pretty well on him. And then LaMarcus Aldridge, I thought, was going to kill the Knicks and really wasn't able to. Hernan Gomez, he was effective against, but Porzingis really wasn't able to create space and get his shot off. Same thing even with O'Quinn. So they did well to defend him, and it was a weird game because they gave up a billion offensive rebounds and turned the ball over a ton in the first half, but they really scored extremely well outside of that. I think they had like 63% field goal percentage in the first half, for example, and then they're able to just down the end score with a bunch of isolations for Melo, tough shots, like he made a really tough right shoulder fadeaway when a double team came over, and then Derrick Rose with his second whole assist of the game found Melo for a wide open pick and pop jumper when the Spurs miscommunicated. They should have been switching between Green and Kawhi, and they doubled Rose for some weird reason.
The only thing I want to add in here is just a little bit of a plug for myself, is that Chris Herring and I, who now writes for 538, talked about the Knicks a fair amount on Real Jam Radio, which should be out actually by the time most people listen to this.
Justin Holiday, I thought it was ironic that he was playing Danny Green, because he's kind of like Danny Green without the defense at this point. Just should never dribble. He had a couple of horrendous turnovers as he tried to dribble into traffic. And I did like what Courtney Lee was able to do off the dribble in this game, but that was really an aberration. That's not, he made a couple of jumpers off the dribble, long twos, even a three off the dribble, which was shocking, but then it had a couple of drives in that were fruitless. That's not something that's going to be a part of his game right now at age 31, but it was, at least for that game, it helped them win.
It did. Anything else on them? You're ready to move on to Orlando.
Well, I think Hernan Gomez, we should still talk about
him. Oh yeah,
him.
That's true. We should.
Give him some credit. I said earlier in the year that Kyle O'Quinn should play more than him, and Kyle O'Quinn somehow has a 21 PER, which is pretty incredible. But Hernan Gomez, I liked his pick and roll defense in this one. I thought that he generally was able to not get torched. The Spurs don't have anyone who has a lot of speed in the pick and roll. Tony Parker isn't that guy anymore. Parker was terrible in this game. He only had 3 shots in 27 minutes and he missed all of them. But he was good at playing the angles. His defensive rebounding is outstanding, 27% defensive rebound rate. He's also been getting on the offensive glass, 13% offensive rebounds, 580 true shooting, 19 PER for a 22-year-old rookie who's a smart player. He's not a guy that I see as a ton of upside, and he's had a couple of times where trying to come down the lane just didn't have the explosion to finish over shot blockers. But, you know, he could be a real player.
I like him a lot, and I've been surprised by how much I've enjoyed his fit with Porzingis. It's not perfect, but playing that, I don't think that's your starting front court, but if you play those guys together 10 to 15 minutes a game, totally cool with it.
One thing that I thought was a little disappointing was Porzingis rolled to the basket more than you would expect, actually, on pick and rolls, but then he was just rolling right into Hernan Gomez or O'Quinn the whole time, and they just could never get him the ball on those plays. It would really be nice to see what he could do with a space floor, maybe get up for some alley-oops in the pick and roll, come down and come down the lane and dunk on people. But with the spacing they have on this team, wasn't good. Also, Lance Thomas, I thought, was effective in this one. It made a three. He's going to be a good player as long as he hits shots. That's really just the question for him, is whether he's going to make his threes or not. Only had 1 year really in his career of doing that so far. Let's move on, though, to the Orlando Magic.
The Magic are 21-36 after a win today against the previously surging Miami Heat. 4-11 since the last time we did this. 29th in offense, 22nd in defense, negative 6.4 net rating. 538 gives them a 2% chance of making the playoffs, and they're projected to be tied for 13th in the East with 31 wins.
Yeah, and that 31 wins with that negative 6.4 net rating is actually, they are actually overperforming their point differential all year, which is, remember when they beat the Spurs in San Antonio, like, oh, maybe they really turned the corner here. That has not been the case.
My mea culpa for that is now been undone. I want to take back my mea culpa after saying I was too hard on the Magic.
I mean, yeah, I still, again, how these guys could be 22nd in defense with the talent that they have, I have no idea. But what I wanted to talk about for Orlando is, what would you take for Ibaka? Let's throw out the whole Hennigan might get fired thing, gotta save face. Just like, what's a reasonable price for him?
I'd love to get a late first.
Yeah, no, I think that's about right. Or a decent prospect who could be a rotation player on a cheap contract.
Yeah, and they're a logical team. They're never going to do this, but they're a logical team to take on a player who's talented, but on a contract that maybe their team doesn't like so much. Incidentally, kind of like Tobias Harris is on a pretty good contract. I was going to say Tobias Harris, but those sorts of guys, because we've already seen that they won't have much of a use for their cap space. They ended up spending $15 million on Jeff Green because they didn't have anything else to do.
Okay, next question on Ibaka, because this actually, I think, is important about what you can expect to get back from him. We've talked about how he's going to get overpaid. I'm not sure that that's the case. We'll have to see. But what kind of contract do you think he would deserve to get? Like, if you were a GM just in a vacuum and you wanted to pay him properly for his services over the next 3 or 4 years at the ostensible age of 27, what would you deserve to get paid?
Ostensible's nice. I think right now he's worth about the mid-level exception. So the middle, I'm throwing that around 7-8 million, you know, because the mid-level exception is, of course, going up in the new CBA, but he'll be worth less over time. So if you started there and descended it, probably.
So you don't even think he's like an average starting power forward?
Hell no, not right now. I mean,
he's having a great offensive season.
Yeah, he is, but defensively, he can't really stick with those guys as much anymore. The Magic have been awful with him on the floor defensively. And, you know, Bismack Biyombo, you would expect that lineup. And some of that, of course, is other things that are going on with their team. But I think of him more as a backup at this point. And I think of him more as a backup five than a four.
Oof. Wow. That is that's pretty rough to think of him as a backup at this point. I'm not that low on him, especially because he's clearly been in a pretty crappy situation there. Like, you can say that he hasn't been part of the solution, but, you know, he was playing great defense as recently as, you know, two series against great teams last year. I think.
Yeah, but remember, before that, we were talking about the concerns that he was going to have it. You know, if we think back to the 15 and 60s this time last year, we were not that as optimistic that his defense was going to come around. It did for that stretch of time, but he's also at least he's a year older at this point, and then they're not going to be in the playoffs this year. So I don't know. I'm not as comfortable with the idea of him as a starter. That said, I don't think there's that much of a difference for most teams between your second big man and your third big man, because third big men often play as much as a starter. And I think Ibaka, at least starting, like his next contract will be at that level.
Yeah, I think he's still is a quality starting power forward. I'm not willing to just completely write him off based on this season, especially how well that he's done offensively. And I think he could get more run at center. Was good at center in the playoffs last year. So maybe I'm overrating the playoffs a little bit too much, but I don't know if I necessarily want to count on this terrible situation in Orlando for my evaluation. And so I would say a four-year deal between like 15, 16 million a year is like something that I would be comfortable paying, realizing that you're probably going to be a little bit of an overpay on the back end there, especially if these age issues are, you know, he's older than 27. But yeah, so and what is he going to get, 20?
Yeah, probably something in that range.
Yeah, so, but that's interesting to think of. And his cap hold is going to be 18. So that's something to consider there as well. That's why I still don't think it makes a ton of sense for Miami to get him, but we'll see. The other thing I wanted to talk about too is, you know, Mario Hezonja has flopped again. He's had plenty of opportunities. I couldn't even get a first rounder for him in the mock trade deadline podcast. So, but I think it's worth going back and looking at that decision to talk about who they passed on, who is really being talked about in that range, because number six was Willie Cauley-Stein. I don't think that would have been some great pick. Justice Winslow, yeah, looking like he's effective. Stanley Johnson has been better than Hezonja has been, but not by a ton. I think Stanley, I feel better about both those guys than Stanley, but it's not like either any of those guys have been world beaters. Moutier too, I think he can be a starting point guard in the league still, but he hasn't been great or anything. I think Moutier would have been my pick. They had just drafted Payton the year before. I think one of the big flaws of this management has been believing too much in Alfred Payton. But I mean, you really have to go down to Miles Turner at 11 to be like, oh man, this was the guy who would have been worthy of this pick. And no one was talking about Turner in that range.
Exactly. And that gets into the frustration that I have sometimes when draft picks in particular get criticized, because you can't say, oh, they should have drafted Miles Turner over Hezonja.
Yeah, considering, or Devin Booker or Trey Lyles. Yeah. Like, none of those guys were being even remotely talked about in that range.
I mean, I had Miles Turner over Porzingis, but even I wouldn't even criticize them for that, because I was an outlier, and because I was on the Miles Turner train, and I can't even remember where I had Hezonja relative to that. So it didn't work out. I would have taken Moutier at that spot because I think he was a believer, and I'm sure the reason they didn't do that is because of Alfred Payton. And that's a big problem when you feel like you can't take somebody else, even though you're not sure the guy you have is the answer.
Let's move on to Philly.
The Sixers are 21-34, 9-8 since the last time we did this, though a lot of that was a little while ago. Still dead last in offense, 15th in defense, -6 net rating, 3% chance of making the playoffs, and they're tied with the Magic in the 538 projections for 13th in the East at 31 wins.
However, they've been extremely effective, as we've talked about before, but deserves to be reiterated, in Joel Embiid's minutes this year.
Yeah, they're +3.2 in net rating during his minutes, and the starter net rating, this does not include their most recent game, but their starter net rating since Embiid's last game is -18.9 and -11.6 since his second to last game, because he had that one game against the Rockets that he played.
Yeah, so he's pretty important to their success. Ben Simmons, still not any kind of a timetable for return. Brett Brown intimating that the foot is not quite where they want it to be, which is a little bit surprising. I mean, I guess he's going to say that because he doesn't want to imply that he's healthy and they're just being extra cautious, or his representation wants him to sit out even longer or whatever it is. If that in fact is true, though, that's a concern. I mean, that injury is supposed to be a 6 to 8 week recovery time. And sure, you want to be really conservative with that, with some of the histories of Jones fractures, especially for that initial surgery that has a relatively high rate of injury recurrence, as happened, of course, with Kevin Durant. But, you know, it'd be nice to see him at some point soon. I mean, this team without Embiid gets back to being pretty unwatchable. But I think it's good for them in the aggregate. And they're going to be very conservative with Embiid. We talked on the Twitter NBA show about he has this very small tear in his meniscus that supposedly is not going to require surgery. But enough of this crap. Jahlil Okafor, not on the team plane, didn't play. Brett Brown acknowledged that it's due to some trade talks. I guess that makes sense because he's so injury prone lately that it's probably better to just keep him out. And he also changed his location on Twitter to Chicago, which I'm guessing that means more that he's just kind of like going home to just chill there for a while, as opposed to that he's being traded to Chicago. So the question is, outside of the idea of, you know, who has the assets to send back and all that, and what team really even needs Jahlil Okafor's services at this point?
We're moving further and further away from the idea of him being a long-term starter. So
Well, hold on. So why is that? I mean, if you, what's happened between this summer and now that makes you feel so much more certain that he's not a long-term starter?
Well, I don't, but I'm just saying the perception is probably that way just because he hasn't impressed as much. He had some nice stats last year in the minutes, and he has had just a weird time in Philadelphia with the surrounding talent and everything else. And he hasn't improved on defense very much from what I've seen. And I think
he's gotten a little bit better just watching him. He's made some plays when he's actually been in position. Not going to try and argue he's been good. He's still been terrible. And he also just has really, and perhaps this is a negative, or you could spin it as a negative or a positive, that he's been struggling with this knee. He hasn't really been healthy. You know, didn't have much of a summer to work out either. Didn't play summer league, none of that stuff. So you can say either that maybe that's an excuse, or maybe that's worrying that he has had that injury now that's been kind of dogging him for almost a year now.
The ideal team for me for him was always one that had somebody else as an option at center, but that person was not the long-term answer. I had thought about the Suns as a good example, not saying they should trade for him, but just as an example where they have Tyson Chandler now, but Tyson Chandler is going to age, he's going to wear down. So if they had Okafor, who I like much better than Alex Len, that they would be able to kind of play that both ways. So if he's good, then you can move him in, and if he's bad, if he can't reach that level, then you just play him as a backup. But there aren't even that many teams that need that.
Yeah, I think that Phoenix is a team that makes sense. I don't think that they have any kind of a long-term center on their roster, could use a little more scoring. It's not like they have like the defensive culture to kind of make up and make him work. Another rumor was that New Orleans was willing to move a 2018 first and Alexis Ajinsa, which of course is basically dead salary, and that 2018 first would be lotto protected for Okafor. What do you think of that deal from either side?
That would, in my opinion, that would serve to help New Orleans have a better pick this year, because they'd presumably start Okafor and then have him close games. So that would be nice.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's a good point.
And so you have that benefit as well. I mean, you hope that they would draft well. And that's not much to give up. You know, a lottery protected first. I don't have them, knowing what we know right now, I would say they're less likely to make the playoffs than to make it. We don't know what's going to happen with Jrue Holiday. They've been solid when they've had him, but it's going to be hard for them to improve. And I think that's selling a little bit low for the Sixers, just depending on the protection on the pick. But if it's lottery protected,
when the hell is the next time New Orleans is going to be in the playoffs? If that pick eventually becomes unprotected,
sure,
at some point, then I'm more interested. I mean,
did you hear my evil idea on that? Was that it should be unprotected in 2021, which is the year that Davis could be a free agent. He could be a free agent in 2020. So do basically the bet that they made with the Kings.
No. You got to go 2022, because what's going to happen is he's going to sign the designated veteran extension, and then 1 year and one day after signing it, he will demand a trade.
There we go. See, Nate's playing the long game even better than I am.
It's not this idea that they're going to start him at center. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess then he could come back in when AD is on the bench and maybe help score a little bit, play like 25 or 30 minutes a game. Maybe it's not terrible for New Orleans. I didn't like it at first. I do think that AD should be playing as much center as possible. He doesn't want to do that. He might just have to do that because it's their only chance to win. It's also a trade that I think makes more sense in the summer once New Orleans figures out like who the hell they have on their team. I mean, they might need to make this same trade for someone who can play point guard if they lose Jrue Holiday, you know, so I don't know that it makes sense doing it now. Looks like, though, Philly is adamant about trading Okafor at this point. Okafor doesn't seem particularly happy. I would think they probably want to get him out of there for that reason as well. You mentioned Phoenix. I thought that's a good one. Charlotte, I thought could have used him, especially if they need some scoring in the second unit, but getting Okafor, he's not going to help you this year. Like, that's clear. Like, it's all about having a center for, you know, 2 years from now or so, a guy who averaged 17 a game and was efficient his rookie year on one of the worst offensive teams in NBA history. You put some shooting around him and let him go to work. But he's going to hurt you more on D than he's going to help you on offense at this point. This is more about a move for a team that is thinking long term.
I have another team.
Who is it? Who is it?
Portland. Just as a flyer, give up one of your late firsts for him and salary filler if you have to do it. Just on the idea that you need as many bites of the apple as you can get. He's not expensive. Try it. He's more likely to fit in that spot than, like, let's say Ed Davis. So just try him.
So you want to know who my team, or I think he would be a great fit? The San Antonio Spurs.
Yep, I like it. And considering they could actually get him to play defense.
Yeah, like, they could actually get him to play D.
I'm a fan. Totally on board. Especially considering it looks like they're not going to be a cap team this summer with that reporting or with the idea that that Powell's going to opt in.
Yeah, I'm sure they could cobble together the salary. I haven't looked at exactly who that would be, but I'm sure that they could find somebody who would work there. You know, maybe something along the lines of like Kyle Anderson. Actually, they really don't have a ton of salary.
You know that I was the Spurs in our trade deadline and I was considering trading for Jahlil Okafor.
Well, and then also there's the question of, is the 29th pick in the draft really enough to entice Philly at this point? And maybe it's not. And maybe someone will come with a higher offer. There's still talk that Chicago might be into it. I don't really think he makes a ton of sense there, but it is a way to get some talent on the roster. Maybe Okafor still can become something. I'm still higher on him maybe than some people are. But there are not many of us anymore, and I certainly acknowledge a high probability that he's never going to get it defensively, but I think he can still be a really, really good offensive player.
How would you feel about Dallas? Yeah. Is
Yeah, that's a thought too, potentially. Again, a team that isn't really going anywhere right now. That would make a little bit of sense.
Yeah, let's run an offense around Harrison Barnes and Jahlil Okafor. That would be fun.
Not a lot of passing in that group. Not a lot of ball. All right, that's probably enough on Okafor. I mean, if you're just going to give me a wild ass guess of where he ends up.
New Orleans. I don't want it, but a guy like Jahlil Okafor almost never ends up where I want him to. It's just the rule.
Yeah, that seems the most likely also. Let's move on, finish things up here with the Washington Wizards, who are surging right now. 13-2 in their last 15.
33-21 overall, ninth in offense, ninth in defense, +3 net rating, 3% chance of actually finishing number one in the East, 2% title odds per 538, currently projected to finish third in the East ahead of the Raptors with 49 wins.
What have they been doing since New Year's? Give me some more stats on this incredible run that they've been on.
So from New Year's through Saturday, so not including their most recent game, the Wizards are third in net rating, +6.7, behind only the Warriors and the Spurs. They're third in starter net rating, +9.3, and they're 14th in bench, which is substantially better than where they were at the beginning of the year. They're basically even in terms of bench net rating.
Yeah, that's been huge, and just overall their defense getting better. You mentioned their ninth in defense for the season, and since they started off so poorly, I would imagine much better than that during this streak. And this offense is just nasty right now. And Prada was tweeting about this today, that Otto Porter is a lights out shooter right now. Doesn't have a ton of versatility to his three, but if you throw it to him and he's got an open one, you're in big trouble. Brad Beal has a ton of versatility to his three pointers. He is a knockdown shooter. He's been having some monster games lately. Markieff Morris has really validating that trade that they made for the 13th pick from the Suns. He's been an effective power forward option as time has gone on here this year. He's been trying harder to defensively as well. That's been big. Gortat, still a great pick and roll defensive center. I think the fact that they've been able to get now into the top 10 in defense with not a ton of defensive talent at this point, I mean, they're kind of clustered around a bunch of other teams, but nonetheless, I mean, if you're top 10 in both, you're a pretty damn good team. They are ninth, but yeah, I mean, they really are surging right now. Do you think they could be, I mean, I if they just like the playoffs just started today, I might favor them to make the East Finals. They're the third seed right now.
I would favor them to make the East Finals right now.
Yeah,
you think I was wondering if you would say they would take, how many games they would take from the Cavs in a series right now.
Oh, like one or two.
Yeah, I think two. But when JR gets back, that gets tighter because JR and Washington needs all, they need basically all four.
Oh yeah, I guess
it was players.
Right now. Yeah, I guess it would probably be two right now when JR gets back, maybe one or two. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry. So you're saying they need all four of their best players?
Right. So they need Porter, Gortat, and obviously Wall and Beal, because they don't really have replacements for those guys. Oubre and Markieff gets a little bit, you know, more fungible, but they've, as long as they stay healthy, they're going to be a really tough out. I really enjoy watching this team.
Yeah, that's a great point too. Oubre, they've been effective with him on the floor. His numbers overall this season, not that great. Only 30% three-point shooting, still under a 10 PER, but lineups with him at the four have been good. He actually guarded Isaiah Thomas down the street stretch in a game. They put him on point guards. He's been pretty good. Still can't go right, but you know, I'm going to be saying that 10 years from now when we're talking about his career. And yeah, I think if you just look, the fact that he was kind of known as this project, really athletic, but maybe not that heady of a player, the fact that they've been able to play effective ball with him on the floor is encouraging. But if you think about it, really, their top six guys, if you put Oubre in there, I mean, Mahimi was supposed to be a top six guy, and he's still coming along. He's only he's a negative 33 in his four games this season. At least he's playing, though. But their top six guys this year, basically in terms of minutes, all have really exceeded expectations so far this year, and that's how you have a breakout season like this.
It is, especially when those guys are on the floor a lot. And I wanted to look into it a little bit. I didn't spend a ton of time, but they were, as of when I looked at it, I think it was Saturday or Sunday, they were bottom 10 in opponent effective field goal percentage, but still ninth in defense. And there are some reasons why that is troubling. One of them is that they are forcing a lot of turnovers. They're second highest in turnover rate, but they're not great defensive rebounding and they're fouling a fair amount. So you start to wonder if, you know, their first shot defense has been good, but is that going to sustain enough? And Mahimi will help, but if they fall off, it's going to be on that end.
Yeah, I mean, even Jason Smith is like having an awesome year by his standards. Trey Burke now is getting to where he's been acceptable lately. This is a very formidable team. How many games are they projected to finish behind the Celtics right now?
54-28 versus 49-33, but they are 2.5 games separated at the moment.
Huh. I wonder why that is. Maybe it's just that the Wizards' schedule gets a lot harder or something.
I think it's also that on the season overall, Boston has been a little bit better, but that's because the Wizards were so bad at the start.
Yeah. Who could have, that 2-8 start, who could have predicted that they would be at this level at this point?
That they'd be ahead of the Raptors? I mean, remember how hot the Raptors started?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. That's crazy to think that we'd be. I mean, we've seen a lot of teams just have some pretty wild fluctuations this year. You think about Miami, Philly had like a great run. Toronto was awesome. Now they've been really bad.
The Pacers went from being like we were talking about, like, what should they like scrap things, to being a surefire playoff team.
The Knicks were even 16-13 at one point, but that was more just luck. I'm talking about even not even just like getting lucky in close games with your record, but just the quality of play. Like the Bucks were like projected to be the 4 seed at one point. Now they might not even make the playoffs. Basically every team in the East has really had these moments. Like the Bulls were looking really good for a time, like 15 games into the season. The Hornets were looking like they were going to be the fourth or fifth seed, and now they've been on this enormous free fall without Zeller.
If one of our listeners,
the Nets were 4-5 at one point. All right.
If one of our listeners wanted to do it, it would be fascinating if you can go through it, like with the 538 playoff percentages. I think that'd probably be the best thing to look at. And the high watermark and the low watermark for every team in the East, I think would be really interesting.
And Atlanta had started off 8-2, or maybe even 9-2. Then they lost 10 out of 11, and now they're 32-23. It's like, it's really been pretty remarkable. All of these crazy, and even the Cavs had that really ugly stretch, although that's probably too much is made out of that. But yeah, really a lot of crazy fluctuations here in the East, maybe giving a little bit of a lie to the people who say, oh, you know, once the first 20 games are over, you know what the standings are. That has not been the case so far in the East.
No, and we could also see this move again with the trade deadline, depending on how these teams identify themselves. And also, that's probably changed the direction of some of these. I mean, remember with Atlanta when the Korver trade happened, it's like, oh, well, it's time to sell everything. And now they're the 5 seed. It's crazy.
Yeah. All right. That'll do it for today. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget about our sponsors, stamps.com. Use that CapSpace code to get a 4-week trial, including postage and a digital scale. And then Betterment.com/CapSpace is how you can get started with them with up to 6 months of no fees. Programming note here, this will be our last one, I think, for this week with the All-Star break going up. I think we're both going to go on vacation with no games, but we'll come back with 3 episodes next week as well. Obviously, the trade deadline, Danny will be incommunicado for that one, on a cruise, getting a ton of sun, but a special guest will be joining me for the Twitter NBA show that night, and also a Dunked On as well, and we'll have some more content as well. Got some interesting things planned for when there are no games. Try to take things a little bit more of a unique direction. So we'll talk to y'all next week. Till then.